nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
All right, so today we're going to be talking about continuing our discussion about technology-independent optimization in multi-level synthesis. Summarizing the discussion from the previous lecture, we learned that 0-1 matrices can be used to represent sets and perform operations on sets. And in particular, prime rectangles in 0-1 matrices represent intersections between different sets. So when you're trying to represent sets as a 0-1 matrix, the rows correspond to the sets in consideration, and the columns are the elements of the sets. So prime rectangles refer to column elements that are common to more than one row, and therefore they represent intersections of the sets. And we studied the application of this data structure to extraction in technology independent logic optimization. The first specific application was using the cube literal matrix for a single expression and constructing this matrix and identifying prime rectangles in this matrix yields the kernels and co-kernels of that expression. So that's the first application. The second application was when you construct the cube literal matrix but stack them together for multiple expressions at the same time and try to look at prime rectangles that cover rows from multiple expressions, then that gives you common single cube factors among those expressions. And similarly, when we are analogously, if you look at the a different 0-1 matrix, the co-kernel cube matrix, where the rows are co-kernels and the columns are unique cubes of kernels, and again, identify prime rectangles in that 0-1 matrix, it turns out that that gives you the multi-cube factors. So essentially, this gives us an opportunity to formulate the entire problem of extraction of common factors purely as operations on 0-1 matrices. And we also looked at how you guide the selection of the best factor just by looking at the matrix. Of course, the cost function we are trying to use here is literal count. So we would like to perform extract common factors that minimize the literals required to implement the network. But rather than go back and reflect the changes of the factoring on the logic expressions and recompute literal count, we saw that this notion of value of rectangles in these matrices could be used to directly compute the literal savings that is going to result, right? So far, if you think of everything we've talked about and try to put it together into some sort of a procedure for extraction using the 0-1 matrices, essentially this could be a sort of a heuristic approach to factoring. You know, just repeating the fact that value is a good measure is actually a measure of change in number of literals. So exploiting that, you can think of the following procedure. Given a 0-1 matrix, find a rectangle that has maximum value as large as possible. And again, here you can choose to either be exact or heuristic. Given the fact that overall multi-level synthesis or multi-level optimization is a hopelessly challenging problem, and therefore you're, you know, abandoning hope of optimality anyway from the first place, optimality in some sub-problem is not of much consequence. So in practice, you know, a heuristic works pretty well. So find a rectangle of value that's as high as possible, extract it. The part that we have not discussed is once you extract it, typically in order to get a good amount of savings of literals in the overall network, you need to perform a sequence of extractions. Now, you know, if these extractions touch completely disjoint subsets of nodes, that's okay. But often in practice, they actually end up touching the same set of nodes more than once. So in which case, it becomes important to update the matrix and do that efficiently so that you can have a recursive, repeated execution of these three steps to extract a sequence of factors so that you have a significant savings at the network scale, right? Extracting just one factor is unlikely to help you a whole lot. You need to extract typically, you know, perform these steps several times. In order to do that efficiently and keep the entire operation, set of operations in the 0-1 matrix representation, we need to figure out how to reflect the extraction of a factor and the update on the network that would result from extracting that factor purely in the matrix representation. So that's the problem we will study. Next. So just like when we discussed value, we said that there are two different cases we need to consider because the matrices are different. The single cube factor extraction happens on the cube literal matrix. Multi-cube factor extraction happens on the co-kernel cube matrix. So we define value differently for these two cases. But in both cases, reflected the literal savings. Similarly, we will again discuss the matrix update. How do you update the matrix for both of these cases separately? Okay. So first, let's discuss the single cube case. So you're extracting a single cube factor. You constructed the cube literal matrix. You identified a rectangle there which is of highest value, and that's the single cube factor you want to extract. How do you update the matrix so that you can go ahead and start finding the next rectangle or the next factor, right? The reason you need to update the matrix is because once you actually extract the factor, the network has changed. The Boolean network has changed. The expressions inside some of the nodes have changed. Okay. So there are three steps that you need to do to update this cube literal matrix. The first step is that you just add a column at the end of, so this is the original matrix, in the example that, and the factor you're extracting here, the single cube factor is AB. So as you can see, you know, AB is common to the rows 1, 2, and 4. So if you extract AB as a single cube factor, the first thing you need to do is now you need to add an additional column at the end of the matrix, because the output, if you think of the network level view of what happens here, you've created a new node in the network, right? And that node implements this common factor. It implements the function AB. So you add a row with corresponding to AB, because AB is a cube of this new node in the network. But you also, the output of this node in the network now becomes a literal that appears in some of the other nodes of the network, right? Because that's exactly what happens when you extract a factor out. So you add a column to the network called X here, and you add ones in appropriate entries of that column. Okay. So, to recap, once you've extracted the factor AB, you need to add a new column to the matrix, and you need to add a new row to the matrix. Those are the obvious changes that you need to do. And the new column just represents the new literal representing the output of this new node, that the factor that you extracted as a new node. And the new row just represents the fact that that new node has one cube, right? So now, how do you add, populate the entries of this row and this column? Remember, what do the entries mean? This is the cube literal matrix. So these are just cubes and the literals that belong to those cubes. So in this case, if you have AB here, you will add ones in the A and B columns in this last row, right? Indicating that this cube also has the literals A and B. And what would you do in this column? Which entries do you think are going to be one in the column? X is now a new literal that appears in the expressions of those nodes that you factored the factor out from, right? So instead of AB, in these cubes ABC, ABD, and AB, FG, AB has been factored out. So AB is now replaced by X. So ABC would turn into CX or XC. In which case, this row needs to have a 1 here in the last column, right? Reflecting the fact that ABC now is really XC. Similarly, ABD is going to be XD, so you'll have a 1 here, and ABFG is going to be XFG, so you will have a 1 here as well, okay? So the way you populate the row and column is pretty straightforward, right? You just do the intuitive thing, and it's correct. Now comes the less intuitive step. So the first two steps are exactly what I described. Add a new row to the matrix, add a new column to the matrix, label them appropriately, and create the entries, the 1 entries. Now, once you have extracted AB out of these terms, remember you're extracting AB out of these terms here, these three cubes here, those cubes are no longer what they were before, right? So these cubes have now changed from ABC to XC. So AB, if you look at the first cube here, it's really going to be XC. So AB doesn't really appear in that cube anymore, right? So one possibility is you could say that now I'm going to change the entries AB to 0. Okay. However, that is not necessarily the right thing to do. Right? So the intuitive thing, or what you might expect, is that since this cube has changed from ABC to XC, A and B no longer appear, so I only need to put 1s in the literals that appear, which is why we argued that, well, C of course has a 1 and X should have a 1. So since it no longer has AB, these entries should now become 0. Similarly, these entries should be 0 and these entries should be 0. So the obvious argument, or you could make a case for taking all the 1 entries of the rectangle that you have extracted out as a factor and just turning them to 0. However, that's not necessarily the right thing to do. Suppose I have a new factor that I would like to extract. Suppose I would like to extract, well, this is not a good example here, but imagine that you had another node with AC. Suppose you would like to extract AC again, right? When you extract AC from that other node, is it okay to extract AC from XC? Yes or no? Two possible answers.
Yes.
Why?
Same expression, you can write ABC as ABC or ABC. So, you can assume that we're extracting it twice from the...
Mm-hmm. So, it is okay to cover, rather than turning these entries to zeros, it is, you want to actually reflect the fact that it is okay to cover these literals again, to extract the same literals again. Okay. And when we do that, I'll be arguing soon that we have just broken one of the laws that we said we are going to follow. We said we're going to do algebraic factoring. Okay. We can do this, but we've actually just broken one of the laws that we set for ourselves. But it's a good thing. I'm going to argue it's a good thing. So you actually want to do this. Okay. So what we're going to do is rather than make these entries zeros, which is the obvious thing to do, we're going to turn these entries into stars. So previously we had only one and zero entries in the matrix. I'm just, you know, using dot as a more convenient notation for zero, so it's not cluttered here. But now we have a third type of entry, don't care, star. Okay? So the third step of the matrix update process is to take all the one entries in the matrix, the entries of the rectangle that you extracted out, and turn them into stars. Why? Because it is okay to cover these literals again with the next rectangle you extract, but on the other hand, it's okay if you don't cover them also. Okay. You don't have to cover them, but it's okay to cover them. It's an option. So that's why you think of them as don't cares in a sense. Okay. Now, you also need to change the definition of rectangles now. Now, this is the way you updated the matrix, right? So this is the matrix you updated. I've just copied the same thing. I've added the one entries here and I've changed the entries to stars. For now, forget the new rectangle, right? Now, you'd like to, in this updated matrix, find the next rectangle, the next factor to extract. When you're finding the next factor to extract, you can redefine the definition of a rectangle. Remember, previously, our definition of a rectangle was it should have only one entries. You know, all the intersection of those row positions and column positions, all those entries should be one. Now you change that to say that as long as it's not zero, it's a valid rectangle. So it can be one or it can be don't care, right? When you do that, suppose you extract, this is the next, for example, this could be the next rectangle that you extract, right? And this is again a prime rectangle. So this is the rectangle now says this is BD, right? So when you extract BD, it is a valid rectangle to extract. Like we just argued, it's okay to cover stars. In this case, you have one entry of the rectangle, which is a star. But this messes up an assumption of the algebraic model that we made, right? Is it clear to everybody why this or how this messes up an assumption of the algebraic model? What would happen to see that? Let's see what would happen in the network level view when you perform the sequence of extractions. The first extraction was AB. After you do that, what happens is you create this new node X equals AB and you substitute X instead of AB wherever it appeared originally. So this is after step one. Now the corresponding updated matrix is here. This is the new prime rectangle. This is step number two, extraction number two. Now you extracted Y equals BD and we're saying here that that is substituted in two places. It's substituted in one here, where you had ABD before. But remember, ABD is no longer ABD. ABD has changed to XD. So now you've changed that to XY, okay? And also in G, because you have... is this an error here? Oh, I'm sorry. H, in H. Okay. In H, because you have BD there, so you substituted Y back in H, right? So there's two places where you have BD, although it's not apparent here that you have BD. If you think of this as ABD, which is what it originally was, you are saying that you can substitute Y here and Y here. And doing this may actually help you save literals. But if you rewrite the expression of F now, from which you extracted two of these factors, and more importantly, impacted the same term, product term, if you resubstitute X equals AB and Y equals BD into F, what you really get is this expression here, right? F equals AB times C plus AB times BD plus EG. So what is happening here is that B has been repeated. Is this an algebraic product based on a definition of algebraic products? No. But is that such a bad thing? It's not a bad thing. In reality, this is what you're really implementing, but functionally you know that it's still correct. Okay. So even though we set out to do algebraic optimization, here's an opportunity to go a little bit beyond algebraic optimization. Okay. So in reality, what happens is that in the single cube case, when you have overlapping rectangles, you extract one rectangle and then another rectangle covers some of those star entries that you create when you update the matrix. Literals get repeated in those product terms. Okay. So from a puristic point of view, if you just say that I want to follow the algebraic model, technically this is a violation of the algebraic model, because remember we said that when you factor f equals dq plus r, d being the divisor, q being the quotient, d and q to be an algebraic product should not have any common variables. But if you look at the example here, we do have a common variable here. Okay, so we are violating an assumption of the algebraic model, because overlapping rectangles will mean that, you know, d and q do end up having common variables, but the bottom line is you're getting algebraic factoring plus plus, okay, a little bit beyond algebraic factoring, right? And this is actually a good thing, because, you know, you're exploring more opportunities. The reason we restricted ourselves to algebraic factoring, and we'll revisit that a little bit later in this lecture, is because Boolean division and Boolean factoring is extremely hard. Okay, algebraic factoring is easy, computationally easier. You can do it more efficiently, okay? So that is the reason you restricted yourself to algebraic factoring, you know, no other reason. And while doing algebraic factoring, you discovered that I'm able to do a little bit beyond. That's okay. So not a big deal. Okay. But it's important to know why you're turning these entries into stars and what side effect they could have. Okay. So any questions about the single cube case? Effects of how do you update the matrix? So you update the matrix by adding a row, adding a column, adding a row, adding a column, turning all the entries of the rectangle into stars, and then go ahead and extract the next best rectangle. If the next rectangle covers some of the star entries that you already turned into stars, you will end up with this kind of a situation where you've gone a little bit beyond the algebraic model for factoring, but that's fine. As long as it saves literals, that's what you care about, right? And the functionality, of course, of the circuit does not change, right? Okay. So if the single cube case is clear, let's move on to the multi-cube case and see what happens analogously. How do you do the matrix update in the multi-cube case? Remember, the matrix here is co-kernel cube matrix. So these are co-kernels of the different expressions. These are cubes of the corresponding kernels. And the one entries are indicate the kernel co-kernel pairs. So for f, with the co-kernel A, the kernel is going to be DE plus F, and so on. Okay? So suppose, you know, for this example, this is the first factor that you selected. You started off with a clean, fresh matrix. It has only 0 and 1 entries. The very first factor you identified, multi-cube factor, is A plus B, right? That's the factor here corresponding to the rectangle shown. You would like to extract this. What do you do after extracting the factor in order to update the matrix to prepare it for identification of the next factor? The first, I'm going to now sort of reverse the order of the steps. We already know that you can change ones into stars, so I'm not going to justify that once again. If you have any questions, feel free to ask, but if not, we'll just say that it's okay to, we already know it's okay to change these ones into stars, the ones covered by the prime rectangle. Since they are already covered by the factor, and they become don't cares, you can cover them, or you don't need to cover them, right? So this is the first obvious change, right? We already know this, so take all the ones that were there in the covered by the rectangle, turn them into stars. The next change is going to be, so that's step number one, change all the ones in the prime rectangle to stars. The second you need to do is remember, these are, you created a new node in the network, right? What have you done? You created a new node that implements the function A plus B. Now, this node in the network can potentially participate in subsequent factorings, right? So you may take a sub-expression of this node and some other node, which is a common factor, multi-cube factor, and then extract that out. So in order to do that, or reflect that, you need to take this expression for the new node and compute its kernels, okay? This is a trivial case because you computed A plus B, and in this case, A plus B has only one kernel, which is itself the trivial kernel with a co-kernel of 1. So, you know, the co-kernel of 1, you have A plus B itself. So you add a new row to reflect that, because 1 is the co-kernel, and A plus B is the kernel corresponding to that. So that reflects the new node you added to the network into this matrix. There are no new columns here. Why are there no new columns here? Why should there be no new columns? Remember, this original matrix reflects all the kernels. The columns correspond to the unique cubes of all the kernels of these expressions. And remember that the kernel of a kernel of an expression is also a kernel of the original expression itself. So you computed A plus B as a common factor of some of these expressions. All of the cubes of A plus B should already appear in these kernel cubes, or its kernels as well should already appear in these kernel cubes. Okay. So in general, you will not need to add any new columns. You'll just need to add new rows and add one new row in this case, because there's only one trivial kernel. But if this expression has more kernels, add more rows and add the appropriate one entries. But that's not all. So step one and two. Yes.
Question. The first line, F is A. So A is zero. So I don't know the reason why.
What?
The first line, F equal A. So I think that A should be one. But
why should A be one? Why should?
Because first line in the, yeah.
Okay.
A is written there, so I think, no, the left, the column of the...
Here, A?
Rows. Rows, yeah.
Okay, A?
Yeah, but the table A is zero.
You mean this entry should be one? You think this entry should be one?
Yeah.
Why should that entry be one?
Because previous slide...
Oh, did I miss something else? This is a different example. Yeah, this is a different example. So the single cube case. Okay. Yeah, this is a different example. Yeah, this is a completely different matrix. So this is an example. Remember, the matrix has to be different, right? I don't know. Maybe the expression is the same. I'm not sure. But the matrix here is the cube literal matrix for single cube extraction. For multi cube extraction, the matrix is a co-kernel cube. It's a different matrix, right? So this is a different expression. Does that clarify? Okay, so let's rewind to where we were. So the first two steps are to change all the one entries into stars and to add this new row to reflect the new node, potentially multiple rows if this expression itself had kernels. But in this case, it does not, so just one row. And there is one more step to be done here. Okay, so unlike the single cube case, there is one more step. And that step, there's no new columns. We already saw that as well. But there is one more step that has to be done. This is not sufficient. What you need to do is that there are some other entries in this matrix that also need to become stars. You remember, in the single cube case, we just turned the entries of the rectangle corresponding to the factor that we extracted into stars. Here you do that as well, but you need to turn some of the other one entries also into stars. Why? Why do you think that is the case? Remember, this is the co-kernel kernel cube matrix, right? The co-kernel cube matrix, where if you take the product, if you take any of these ones, if you take the product of the literals represented in the row and the column, that will correspond to a product term in one of the product terms in this expression, right? Now, if you take the set of product terms in the expressions for F, G, and H and map each of those product terms to the one entries in this matrix, what kind of mapping do you think that is? Is it a one-to-one mapping, many-to-one mapping, one-to-many mapping, or a many-to-many? What sort of mapping is that? Can one product term correspond to multiple entries here? In other words, when you're taking the conjunction of the row label and the column label, can you get the same cube in different ways from different positions? Let's look at an example here, right? A, D, E. So this term, why is this term 1? Because in the expression F, you have a product term A, D, E. Right? You have A, D, E as a product term. But there's one way of factoring this out is going to be A into DE, of course, DE plus something. But a different way of factoring this out is going to be DE into A plus something else. Remember, this is your original expression is plus something else, whatever else. Right? But both of these ADEs come from the same ADE term in the original expression. So when you remember to think of this from a network level view, what has happened as a result of the first factoring is that you have taken this ADE term and factored it out. It is no longer ADE. So you have, in a sense, covered it in the factoring. You've touched it. You've taken care of it. This one here also comes from the same ADE term. So again, this one should also be turned into a don't care. Because the purpose of making it a don't care is to reflect the fact that I've already covered that product term of my original SOP expression in the factoring. It is optional from this point onwards whether you want to further factor it or not. Right? So if you look at the expression for F before and after, you're starting with this is the expression for F before, this is the expression for F after, you've taken A plus B and turned that into X, right? A new node implementing X equals A plus B. So you, these two terms together become DEX, the terms AF plus BF together become FX, right? Similarly for G, these four terms are replaced by these two terms. So all of the red terms here have been touched by the factoring in some way. So now you need to take all of these terms and look at all the ones in the matrix that result from these terms that have been touched and turn all of those into stars. So once some term in the original SOP expressions have been covered by a factor, there's no need to consider them, or it's optional to consider them from that point onwards. So again, just repeating the previous example, these are the terms that have been covered. These all four terms in G have been covered, right? How do you reflect this in the co-kernel cube matrix? Well, you know that ADE, you can look at the one entries that are, and see if they, the conjunction of the row and column labels corresponds to one of these terms. And if so, you can turn those ones also into stars. Right? So each one entry in the matrix, as we said, corresponds to a product term in the original SOP expression. So what you do is you identify those that correspond to these covered product terms and turn them into stars. And here, if you look at it, there's eight terms covered or eight ones covered by the original rectangle. There is eight more ones in the matrix that are essentially arise from the same product terms. So they also get turned into stars. So this is the difference, key difference between the single cube and the multi-cube case. Okay, because the mapping of your product terms in your original expression to this one entries in this is it's a one-to-many mapping. One product term here can lead to several different, more than one entry. So just restating, for each product term that is covered by the extracted factor, change all entries corresponding to that term into star. So some of them will be within the rectangle, others are outside. Once you do that, again, when you're looking at the next factor, so once you updated the matrix, when you're trying to extract the next factor, it is okay for the next rectangle you identify to include some star entries. You know, they are don't cares. Just like single cube case, you can include them. Once again, this breaks an assumption of the algebraic model. And to see that, we will look at what really is going on. So suppose, you know, this is the same example, you know, that I was using for the multi-cube case. So I've shown all the entries corresponding to those product terms that are affected by the factoring of the first factoring turned into stars now. So you had 8 plus 8. So all the 16 have been turned into stars. Now the new rectangle that we are identifying is shown here, corresponding to the multi-cube factor A plus C. So first we extracted A plus B as X. Now we, let's say we take A plus C, and that is expressed as Y. If you look at what happens to F after the second factor is also extracted out, essentially, what you're saying is F is DEX plus FX plus DEY plus GY. Now, if you go back and substitute X equals A plus B and Y equals A plus C and multiply it out, you see, what you see is that you have this product term repeated in the SOP expression. So what you're really implementing is this expression instead of the original expression for F, which, well, I don't have the original expression here. It was in the previous slide, but the original expression did not have this repetition. Again, you know that because we are living in the Boolean world of Boolean algebra, you know, anything plus itself doesn't change the functionality, so this is okay. As long as it saves literals, it's fine, right? So basically, the summary is both in the single cube case and multi-cube case, you turn some of these ones into stars, and you add a row or column as appropriate. And when you identify the next factor, it's okay to include stars in the next rectangle, but you will be doing a little bit more than algebraic factoring, right? In the single cube case, you had repeated literals within the same product term. In this case, you have repeated product terms, but both are okay. Functionally, they don't change the function. Is that clear? So is the matrix update part clear? So putting it all together, what we have seen now is that you can identify factors on the matrix, you can compute the desirability of a factor using the value for the literal savings, you can compute that purely on the matrix, and then you can reflect the fact that a factor has been extracted out purely by updating the matrix. So you can do this entire process of iterative process of factoring just by having this matrix and making these incremental updates to the matrix, right, which makes it much more efficient. So to recap extraction of factors, we started off by saying that we'll go with the algebraic model, and to identify common factors under the algebraic model, we introduced the concept of kernels and co-kernels. This helped us because it reduced the search space for potential factors of an expression to looking at just kernels and co-kernels rather than all possible factors. And the unifying theme that we used in order to realize factoring or implement factoring is identification of rectangles in 0-1 matrices. Of course, the 0-1 matrix differs. In the single cube case, it's the cube literal matrix. Multi-cube case, it's the co-kernel cube matrix. And rectangle weights and values are computed. And the values essentially of rectangles essentially estimate the literal saved. The overall approach is you want to be keep doing this iteratively. And we also saw how to update the matrix so that you can keep doing this just on the matrix. But I'd like to point out that the sort of identification of factors to cover the different entries of these matrices so that you have explored all opportunities for factoring, all the product terms of your original expressions, is another sort of covering problem in itself. Okay? So how do you solve this problem? So how do we put this together into an algorithm for rectangle generation? Right? So the overall approach is what we said. Identify a good rectangle based on value, extract it, update the matrix, and keep doing it. But how do you identify a good rectangle? Do you choose the best possible rectangle? Well, that may be an excessively computationally expensive step, right? You may not be able to get the best rectangle. How do you get a good rectangle instead? One of the heuristics that has been proposed for identifying a good rectangle is known as the greedy row heuristic. And the way it works is as follows. You start off with your 0-1 matrix. Start off with a rectangle which is just one row. Of course, you don't care. In both cases, you don't care about single row rectangles because that's not going to give you a common factor across multiple expressions. But you start off with that as your initial seed. Your seed for the rectangle is a single row, okay, which has the highest value. So start off with the row that has the highest value. For example, let's say it's this row here. And then what you do is you add a row, you grow this vertically. You start off with a rectangle that is, short and wide, a single row. You grow it vertically by adding one row such that the resulting rectangle, when you add another row, remember the rectangle has to have only one entries or one and star entries, right? It cannot have zero entries. So you may have to shrink the rectangle horizontally in order to grow it vertically, right? So I'm just conceptually illustrating that here by, this operation. In practice, the row that you add may not be contiguous. Remember, rectangles are just a collection of rows and columns. They don't have to be contiguous. But for the illustration here, I'm going to imagine that they are contiguous and show it that way. So when you grow the rectangle in a vertical dimension, you may have to shrink it horizontally. And you consider all possible row additions, pick the one among all the row additions that has the highest, that gives you the best value for the resulting rectangle, the two-row rectangle, and keep repeating this, iteratively getting, taller and thinner rectangles until you just end up with a single column. So you keep adding, growing the rectangle vertically a row at a time, possibly shrinking it until you get just a single column. So what you've seen is a series of rectangles starting from a single row all the way to a single column, and among these, you pick the best one that you have seen. In other words, the one that has the maximum value among all of these. And that is the factor. Okay? So this is one possible heuristic. You can come up with other heuristics as well, but this is one possible heuristic that works reasonably in practice, which is you start with a row and you keep expanding it vertically until it becomes a column. And, in each case, you try to be greedy when you're expanding, pick the locally best, the best addition of row possible, from a local perspective. And among all the rectangles that you've seen, eventually pick the best rectangle from a value that has the best value. The dual of this you can think of is the greedy column algorithm, which starts off with a column and then keeps expanding it horizontally until you end up with a row. Right? So you can do either one. In practice, what is implemented in MIS and SIS is sort of a hybrid of greedy row and greedy column, okay, which they found to give pretty good results. So again, the objective is, as before, start with a prime rectangle, or find one prime rectangle at a time. Start off with a seed. It could either be a row or a column. In this case, as we'll see, it may not be as important, but start off with a seed row, for example, rectangle with one row and highest value. First, add a row such that the rectangle is of highest value. So this is similar. So far, it's the same as a greedy row. But now, once you've grown it one step in the horizontal direction, in the vertical direction, now try to grow it next in the horizontal direction. So add a column such that the resulting rectangle is of the highest value. So it's the reason it's called ping pong should now be apparent. You're alternating between trying to grow it horizontally and vertically, right? And again, you know, keep repeating this, but here, since you're growing it horizontally and vertically in an alternating manner, you may not essentially end up with a single column, but you stop when the rectangle cannot be improved by growing it either in the horizontal or the vertical direction. Okay. So again, this is sort of a greedy, still a fairly, you know, simplistic greedy algorithm, but it works pretty well in practice. You're alternating, start off with the seed, alternate between growing it horizontally and vertically. And this is how rectangles are identified, right? Okay. So now we've basically covered all the pieces of the puzzle, right? So we've discussed how to identify rectangles. Of course, we know, you know, using value as a metric. We've also discussed how to update the matrix, and you just keep repeating this process, right? At the network level. Okay. Any questions? Don't care doesn't count as far as value is concerned. So only one entries count when you compute the value. And you can again go back and see why that is true, because from a literal savings point of view, by repeatedly factoring the same thing, you are creating, you know, you don't actually benefit from that. So all of the value computation, it still holds if you just ignore the star entries. Treat them like zeros for the purpose of calculating value. Any others?
What is the MIS and SIS?
Oh, MIS and, okay. So I briefly referred to this in earlier classes, so I did not again. So MIS and SIS were basically logic synthesis systems. So you already played with Espresso. Espresso was a two-level logic synthesis system from UC Berkeley. After that, they went on to develop multi-level logic synthesis systems. So we're talking about multi-level synthesis now. So MIS stands for multi-level interactive synthesis. And interactive comes because of the fact that, you know, they implement various commands. For example, extraction of factors is one command. And you as a designer can write a script. You can write a recipe that has a sequence of these commands. Okay. So MIS is, and you will be working with one of these in one of the homeworks, in the fourth homework, the fifth homework, 2 months from now. But MIS basically is multi-level interact combinational circuit synthesis. SIS is a derivative of MIS where they also added sequential circuit optimizations. So S here, you know, M just stands, you know, changed to sequential interactive synthesis, right? But the combinational logic optimization part of both are largely the same. And these are the techniques that we talk about are implemented in those tools. So hopefully when you actually get to do the homework and play with the tools, you can go back and correlate with these concepts and see how these are actually implemented. And from a user's point of view, what the interface is going to be to these techniques. Yeah. Okay. So that brings us to the end of the discussion on algebraic optimization. Okay. So, you know, the algebraic techniques are quite useful, primarily because when you have, they're very efficient, and they of course do give you significant savings in terms of literal count. They, by extracting common logic factors, and, you know, if you start from a network with very little logic sharing, they can optimize the network for area and potentially for power consumption by sharing all of these sub-expressions, which corresponds to sharing transistors or sharing gates eventually in implementation, right? However, algebraic techniques do have this limitation that they do not take advantage of the properties of Boolean algebra, right? So, at least from a conceptual point of view, it is worth discussing if you had access to the full power of Boolean algebra, if you could use all properties, what could you do, right? So, question really is, can we go beyond the algebraic model? Algebraic model is often used in practice, but we know that there are certain optimizations that are left on the table when we stick to the algebraic model. So can we go beyond it? The scope of optimization with algebraic transformations is limited. You know, you're limited to things like collapsing, elimination of a node, extraction of a node, decomposition of a node, substitution of one expression of one node into other nodes, and so on. But the scope of optimization is limited, as I mentioned, because you're not taking advantage of the unique properties of Boolean algebra. So can we revisit what we talked about? We started off by saying what it means to divide one expression by the other. from an algebraic point of view. And then we said, okay, now that we know division, this is what it means for one expression to be a factor of another expression. I can rewrite f equals, you know, d times q plus r, right? What is what does that mean under the Boolean world? So suppose I don't care about just the restrictions of the algebraic model. I'm willing to look at the entire set of laws of Boolean algebra. What does it mean to divide one function by another? What does it mean for a function to be a divisor of another? P is defined to be a Boolean divisor of f if there exists q, which is not equal to 0, which is not the 0 function, and r, such that f can be written as pq plus r. On the surface, this seems like exactly the same as the algebraic model. However, the difference here is this expression is not evaluated algebraically. This equality is like, as long as this function, if you computed its truth table and you took the truth table for f and they are the same in a Boolean sense, then this is a valid Boolean factor. Okay. So the difference is under the algebraic model, this equality you should be able to prove this equality purely by doing algebraic multiplication and just algebraically evaluating this function. Okay, this expression on the right hand side, and you should be able to show purely by algebraic analysis that the two are the same. Now, assume that you can apply all the laws of Boolean algebra here and simplify this expression, or for example, convert both into a canonical form, compute the truth table for both, and are they the same? If they are, then P is a valid Boolean divisor of F. So clearly you would expect that the set of Boolean divisors should be a superset or subset of the set of algebraic divisors. Superset. Okay, good. Why? Because in algebraic divisors, you have access only to a smaller set of laws, a subset of the Boolean algebra laws in order to prove this equality, right? At least this should be the expectation. In Boolean divisors, you have access to all the laws in Boolean algebra. You can perform more simplifications here. You can use stronger analysis to show that they are the same, right? So yeah, you should expect it to be a superset. In the special case where r equals 0, the remainder is 0, q is said to be an exact, both p and q are said to be exact factors of f, okay? So if you have a non-zero remainder, they're factors. If you have zero remainder, they're exact factors. That's the same as the algebraic case. Here is the interesting thing, okay? So we already know that the set of Boolean divisors of a function is a superset of the set of algebraic divisors. But what is really news here is that it is large, extremely large. Any function which has a non-zero intersection with f can be shown to be a Boolean divisor, okay? If f and g is not equal to 0, and this is your standard Boolean conjunction, then g is a valid Boolean divisor of f. Why? Think of it from the Venn diagram representation, right? So think of the functions in terms of their onsets. So what does it mean for f and g not to be equal to 0? So conceptually, if you think of, you know, the circle on the left to be the onset of g, circle on the right to be the onset of f, it means that there are some terms common to both their onsets, right? The set intersection is not null of the onsets. That's what it means. So if this is the case, what the theorem says is you can always, as long as this relationship holds between the onsets of f and g can be any function, as long as it has a non-null intersection with f, you can always rewrite f as gq plus r, right? Where, of course, q is non-zero. Why? So give one example of what q could be. How could you write, just by looking at this Venn diagram, q could be the? Q could be the common intersection. If you just take this collection of onset min terms, for example, there's multiple answers. It's not unique, which is another interesting thing with Boolean division. But if you take all these onset min terms and define that as Q, the common min terms, and define that as in the onset of Q, then G times Q is just this, right? And R will then become what is exclusive to F. So that is one way of writing Q, of defining Q. Any superset of that function, which includes other onset min terms, which are neither in G or F, is also a valid Q. So Q is not unique. But as long as Q contains this intersection of F and G, then F intersection of F and G will always give you this part, and then you can add that to be, say that to be R, and then you're done, right? So as long as F and G have a non-null intersection, and that is a huge space, because you're talking of, remember, if N inputs, G can be, you know, any of those two power N functions, as long as it has a non-null intersection with F. Okay? So any of those functions of N input variables that has a non-null intersection with F, all of those unique functions are all valid divisors now, suddenly, in the Boolean world. So this is, you've grown the problem size by a huge amount. Hopefully this is making it clear again why the algebraic model was good. Right? You didn't have this embarrassing, huge space of divisors, embarrassment of riches, in a sense. Let's talk of factors, right? So a logic function G is an exact Boolean function of a logic factor F. So the divisor is, you know, essentially with a reminder in general, with a non-zero reminder. If you want G to be an exact factor where the remainder is zero, then any G, which is a subset of F, is a valid exact factor of F. Right? So as long as you have this relationship to hold, any G which is a superset of F. So as long as you have this relationship to hold, this is the onset of F. The onset of G is a superset of the onset of F. Then G can always, you can always write F as G and Q plus zero without any remainder. Right? Hopefully that is again apparent by looking at the Venn diagram interpretation. Right? So the bottom line is that the number of Boolean divisors and number of Boolean factors is large. So the approach that we took to algebraic optimization, where you identify divisors, identify factors, identify common factors, is probably not going to work. Of course, we had the kernel co-kernel concept coming in to reduce the search space. There is no analogous concept that is known to date in the Boolean world. Okay, so you don't have that, there is no efficient way of reducing the search space. Boolean division with a given factor is not a problem. So if you have a function G, given, you're given F and you're given G. Somebody somehow tells you, here is F, here is G. Tell me whether G is divisible in F. That can be done easily, right? Because of this theorem. It's just like computing the AND of the two functions. But if you're given one function and asked to enumerate all possible Boolean factors or the Boolean factors that give you the best literal savings, there is no efficient way of doing it because the space is just too large and there is no clear understanding of whether a small subset of the space is sufficient or not sufficient, right? So the problem is not really, well understood. So, and it's a very large space. So basically the approach that we took of identifying common factors does not work very well for Boolean division and Boolean factoring. Okay? So we need to come up with a completely different way of doing this. We want to do Boolean optimization, but we cannot do it by identifying common factors. There's an indirect approach to Boolean division, which is not, what you'd normally imagine. That the obvious approach would be find a factor which is common to two different functions and extract it out as a separate node in the network and then substitute it by computing the quotient and remainder in each of the cases. But there's a different way of doing it. And it turns out that this is another application of two-level minimization to multi-level Boolean optimization. Okay? And the way it works is as follows. So given a function, suppose you're given your f as an f on, f dc, and f off. In general, you may have a don't care set. The special cases, the don't care set is zero. That's fine. But in general, you have a function specified by any two of these three, f on, f dc, and f off. And another function, g. How can you find the quote-unquote best h and r such that gh plus r is a cover for f? Right, so this is how you reformulate it as a two-level. Remember that F and G are expressions within nodes, so they are two-level expressions, right? These are two-level expressions, so we can apply two-level minimization potentially here. So you say that F is one of the expressions. I write F as F on, F dc, and F off. And G is another function. Find the best H and R such that GH plus R is a cover for F. And the best, of course, is going to be defined by literal count, right? You want to have the minimum literal count. So you want to rewrite F as GH plus R such that the literal count of this expression is minimized. So the way you do it is by creating a new variable Y to represent the output of G. Okay, so for example, and add Y not equals G to the don't care set of F. Why are you doing that? Well, you don't have to do it, but it's not incorrect to do it, right? Because essentially what you're saying is, you know, the output of G, for example, if, do I have an example here? Okay, let's start with an, look at the example. F equals A plus BC, G equals A plus B. You want to see if this can be expressed as a Boolean factor of F and express it such that once you, the resulting expression for F has as few literals as possible. So you say, you know that G equals A plus B, represent the output, you know, output of this node G as Y. I could have just called it G, but you know, just create a new variable here, right? To be general. And so the don't care set is nothing but in this case, you know, G is A plus B, so Y not equals G should never happen. Because given the network that you are implementing this in the context of, Y equals G, Y equals A plus B, right? By definition, you're saying that Y equals A plus B. So Y not equals A plus B should never occur, right? So Y not equals A plus B can be thought of as a don't care. You might wonder why we are doing this. It's going to become apparent in a minute, okay? Why are we doing this? I'll explain that in a minute. But for now, just consider the fact that it's okay. It's not, it's correct to do it. It's not incorrect to do it, right? So you take Y XOR A plus B, which is this expression, right? This is nothing but Y XOR A plus B if you simplify it. And this can be added to the don't care set of F. Initially, if F had no don't care set, you create, this becomes the don't care set of F. You do this, and then you do two-level minimization. We know how to do two-level minimization with an on, given onset, given don't care set. That's exactly what Espresso does. Okay. So do two-level minimization for that new function where this don't care set has been added to FDC. However, before you do that, you need to shrink the onset and offset of F correspondingly, because you cannot have any two of these to be overlapping, right? So if you had the original F on onset and offset, you shrink them by taking the conjunction with the complement of this don't care set to make sure that you don't have overlap between these three. Okay. So the problem that you give to the two-level minimizer is you give only F, except you added a new variable now. You added this variable Y, which represents the output of the other node G. Y and G are the same thing. Think of them as the same thing. And you, now, when you do this two-level, originally F did not involve the variable Y. But you now allowed Espresso to utilize, Y is part of the don't care set. Right? You expanded the input space of this function. Originally it was a function of, F was a function of A, B, and C. Now F is now a function of A, B, C, and Y. Because Y is, appears in the don't care set, and now by taking this conjunction, you also forced it to appear in the onset and offset. Okay, so Y appears everywhere in the space. Now if you use Espresso and you modify the cost function of Espresso from product terms to literals, which is a trivial change, by the way, it's not a big deal, you get the minimum two-level cover for this function. When you do that, if the minimum two-level cover involves the Y, what have you effectively done? You've rewritten the expression for F in terms of Y. And that is exactly what Boolean division is. Right? So, there's multiple possibilities when you minimize, in this case, if you look at the example, A plus BC and the complement of this don't care set, with the don't care set equals this. Okay? So you take this, once again, you take this conjunction here only to ensure that the onset and don't care set are mutually disjoint, which is a requirement, of course. And then run Espresso on this function. This function now has one new variable because FDC has also Y in it. And Espresso may give you two answers. But you can bias Espresso to say that I prefer answers with Y. Because answers without Y, I mean, this is a trivial answer. Espresso may come back and say that the original function is also a valid solution again. Right? Of course, it is a valid solution for this two-level minimization problem. But in this case, you also have an alternative solution as A plus YC. If you compute these functions and, you know, use a Karnaugh map and do two-level minimization, you will see that A plus YC is also a valid cover. In this case, it turns out to have the same number of literals as the original. In general, it may not. It may have fewer literals. That's what you're interested in, of course, the case where it has fewer literals. So you force Espresso to include the new variable in the resulting cover for this modified function. And minimize the cost in terms of literals of this cover. If you do that, then once you get this resulting expression, this is equivalent to Boolean division. Because if you look at the product terms that have y, they will give you the quotient, and the other product terms are the remainder, right? The product. So in this case, c is the quotient and a is the remainder in this case. You have rewritten, if you look at this, you have rewritten f as in terms of the new node into something plus something else, right? So you have the quotient and you have the remainder. In general, y may appear in multiple product terms, that's okay. The disjunction of all of those side terms in all the product terms is your quotient, and the product terms where y does not appear is going to be your remainder. So is that clear? This is an indirect way of doing Boolean division. You've not really tried to divide one function by the other, but you have created a new don't care space for the function f. And the don't care is just a statement that g has to be equal to a plus b, or y has to be equal to a plus b. So y not being equal to a plus b just cannot happen, right? Taken by itself, it doesn't seem to make sense. Why? Of course it is true. Why would you care about that? Well, you care about it because you are using this as an indirect way to force the cover for f to include y as a variable, right? By including this in the don't care space, you indirectly force Espresso or give Espresso an opportunity to compute covers that involve y as a variable in the expression for f, which is exactly what you want to do when you're doing division. So this is one possible way in which Boolean division can be implemented and is implemented in practice. And this is more practical, right? Because this is, you know, given f and given g, but of course, again, you know, you need to be given f and you need to be given g. Okay? So you can't go around computing all possible g's. That is still a problem. Given f and given g, this is a way to do division. Okay? Doing division such that you're minimizing the resulting literals in the resulting expression. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, if not, we'll... So that's one way of doing Boolean optimization, which is use true-level minimization to do Boolean division. A different way of performing Boolean optimization, which is also commonly used, perhaps more commonly used in practice, is doing Boolean optimization using don't cares. Of course, we used don't cares already in the previous approach, but what I mean by don't cares here is going to be a little different. So the general strategy, before I get into Boolean, the details of how you do Boolean optimization and don't cares, the general strategy for technology-independent optimization is going to be that you want to use algebraic restructuring as much as possible. As long as you're able to save literals by using algebraic optimization, keep doing it. Okay? Once you reached a saturation point there, algebraic optimization is no longer useful, you're almost at a deadlock, you're at an impasse, you would like to break that by bringing some more powerful technique to the table. As long as algebraic optimization works, it's faster, so why not let it work? Let it keep reducing the literals. Once it has run out of steam, then bring the more powerful technique. Right? Don't unnecessarily use a big hammer when you don't have to, in other words. Right? So now, when that runs out of steam, so once circuit restructuring, if you think of algebraic optimization, essentially, you can think of it as circuit restructuring. You're taking common factors, introducing these nodes, adding more dependencies in the network. Then you use Boolean methods once they have run out of steam to perform further circuit simplification. So, don't cares, we all know about don't cares. Just a quick recap from your undergraduate design course. One, there's two types of don't cares, but the most common don't cares are the ones that are, for example, input patterns that could never occur. You're building a circuit, you know that given the environment in which the circuit is going to actually operate, certain input patterns will never appear. For example, you're implementing a BCD, binary coded decimal incrementer, right? So these are decimal values coded using 4 bits. So you know that these values are always going to be between 0 and 9, right? So all the other values among the 16 possibilities, so all the other combinations are never going to occur, right? These 6 combinations are all don't cares here, right? Because only certain patterns, these patterns cannot happen. It's only pattern 0000 through 1001 that can occur, that are valid BCD codes. And you take advantage of that in simplifying the logic of this incrementer. This is one type of don't care. Right? And this is useful. This is still useful in multi-level optimization. You know how to do two-level optimization with this, you know, using the Carnot map. The usual don't cares also occur in multi-level networks. However, but for the usual don't cares, somebody needs to tell you that, hey, these input combinations are never going to occur, right? These are therefore known as explicit don't cares, right? Because somebody has explicitly told you that these input patterns are don't cares, However, in the context of multi-level networks, it turns out that there's a totally different class of don't cares. Explicit don't cares are, of course, useful, but there's a completely new class of don't cares that occur purely due to the circuit structure. The fact that certain nodes are feeding certain other nodes, the fact that some two nodes may have the same shared inputs, these sorts of structural implications or structural correlations, constraints imposed by the network structure, result in don't cares. And that's what we're going to be talking about in this discussion following now, right? Implicit, these are called implicit don't cares, because somebody can just give you a circuit and not tell you anything about the environment in which it's going to operate. And you can still derive some don't cares for parts of the circuit. You can look at one part of the circuit and say, hey, the rest of the circuit is my environment. Okay, I don't know what happens at the inputs of my big circuit or the outputs of my entire circuit, but for this sub-circuit sitting in the middle, I know its little environment here. So for it, I can compute don't cares without knowing anything about the true external environment. And these are called implicit don't cares. So we'll quickly talk about implicit don't cares in Boolean networks. And I'll try to give you, in the next lecture, I'll give you a more rigorous definition of implicit don't cares and show you how to optimize Boolean networks using these implicit don't cares. And it turns out that Boolean networks, networks of these Boolean expressions that are fully optimized with respect to implicit don't cares, have some special properties. And we'll talk about them. Okay. So I'll just spend a few minutes giving you an informal introduction to don't cares, implicit don't cares in particular. Suppose this is your entire Boolean network and you have a node here that is sitting in the middle of the network. I'm not telling you anything about the inputs here or the outputs here, so you don't know anything about the environment of the circuit as a whole. However, this node sits in the environment of certain other gates that are feeding it and using its output, right? So the question is, by purely analyzing the environment of this node within the circuit, how do you compute don't cares? If I just gave you this node and told you nothing about what is around it, can you tell me anything about don't cares for the node itself? I see a few startled faces. The answer is no. It is no. Right? Not asking you for the impossible. So if I just gave you this node alone and did not tell you anything about what is around it, no, you cannot say anything about don't cares. Now, however, suppose I give you a little more information about the node. Suppose I tell you now that this node has three, of course, you knew that the node has three inputs, Y, B, and X. Suppose I tell you that X is A, B. So this is one of the nodes. I still don't tell you everything about the network. I've just given you a little information about the network. That this X is a node that computes AB. Now, can you tell me something about don't cares for this node?
X is 1, B equals 0, Y whatever can never.
X equals 1, B equals 0 can never occur. Is that clear? Apparent to everybody as to why it can never occur? Because if B is 0, automatically X is, this is an AND gate, so X will be forced to 0. So you'll never have a situation for this node in the context of this network where it will see inputs of 1 at X and 0 at B. That combination can never occur. Right? So you can say something about the don't cares for node F. Right? So essentially what you do is you look at values of this node, or actually values of this node. The way you do this a little more systematically is this node imposes certain constraints between its inputs and outputs. Right? The fact that this is an AND gate tells you that the value of X is constrained by the values of A and B. So look at the impossible values of A, B, and X. So if you have A, B, and X, which values of, think of now a three input truth table, which tells you, you know, given possible values at A, B, and X, which are feasible given this functionality of this gate and which are not feasible, right? So if you look at it, of these eight possibilities, there will be only four possibilities that are possible and four that are not, right? So I guess we could just enter them in here. So if you look at ABX from 0, 0, 0, is this possible?
Yes.
Zero, one for an AND gate. Output should be zero. Yes? No? So as we said, of these, the truth table of an AND gate has only 4 entries, right? So you know of these, in this expanded space of 8 possibilities, only 4 are valid. 4 of these combinations are consistent with the functionality of the AND gate. The other 4 are inconsistent. Okay? So basically, in a sense, with respect to this network, you know that these 4 cases are don't cares. Right? Right? So these 4 combinations of A, B, and X are don't cares. However, what are you trying to do? You're trying to, you're not, that doesn't help you in optimizing node X itself. That you're just restating what node X function is. But you're trying to take this information and now optimize node F using this information. However, what does it mean, what does it take to optimize node F? You want to not optimize node F, so you need to express don't cares in terms of its inputs. Remember, we are trying to do simplification of this expression, right? So this is the expression for F. Can I simplify this expression by computing some don't cares for it? In order to do that, you need to take this don't cares and project them onto the space of these inputs of the node of interest, right? So you need to, with this information about what A, B, X are possible or not possible, can you say something about what possibilities of, what values of X, B, and Y are feasible or not feasible? Again, it goes back to taking a subset of these, or taking this information and saying that, okay, based on this information, now I know that X equals, now this goes back to what Shankar said, right? So he basically said this by intuition, but I'm trying to derive this, that same intuition using a more systematic process, because eventually we're going to have to automate this, right? So we need to be able to do this more systematically. So you know that X equals 1, B equals 0 will never occur. So any combinations of X equals 1, B equals 0, so basically, you know, this one is going to be a don't care, right? 1, 0, 0 is a don't care, and 1, 0, 1 is going to be a don't care as well. These two possibilities are don't cares, right? These two rows. So you know that these two rows are basically don't cares. Now, if you go back to the expression that you had for F, this is the Karnaugh map for that expression, right? Add those don't cares that you have and simplify. What do you get? So let's do that and we'll stop for today. This is the expression here. Now, what are the don't cares? It was X equals 1, B equals 0. So this basically becomes a don't care, and this becomes a don't care. So what do you get when you simplify this expression? So just by visual inspection, you can say what you get, right? This would be one product term. Right? And this will be a second product term, right? Make sense? So F equals, what is this? X. The product term here is X, and this one is? Y, B. Okay. So you started off with a more complex expression, XB plus BY plus XY, and simplified it to, by the way, if you look at this expression itself, in the Karnaugh map, this expression is optimal as it stands, without the don't care information. Once you add the don't care information, you've been able to simplify this expression. Okay? So effectively, what have we done? We have computed don't cares for a node based on some information about the node that feeds it. And using that don't care information, we have simplified the expression that goes, that is inside the node. This is, of course, your classical two-level. I did it with the Karnaugh map. You can use Espresso to do this. Right? So this process we will continue similar to this input side nodes. You can get information from output nodes, nodes that F feeds, and use that to further simplify F. And we will look at that process in the next lecture. And we will also try to more rigorously define, because we need to automatically compute these don't cares. So we'll more rigorously define how you compute these implicit don't cares and how you optimize. How you optimize part is rather obvious. Once you have the don't cares in terms of these inputs, you can just optimize the expression for the inside this node. Okay. So let's quickly summarize. So today we basically finished the discussion on algebraic optimization. We looked at what happens, how do you update the matrices when you're doing algebraic optimization, and the side effects of that, which is technically violating the algebraic assumption. And then we talked about the ping-pong algorithm for generating rectangles. And we started our discussion on Boolean optimization, right? We observed that Boolean division and factoring are much, much harder than the algebraic counterparts, which is why we don't do them in practice, because the number of Boolean factors and divisors is very large. One possible approach to Boolean division is using two-level minimization, that we saw the indirect way of doing it. And the most commonly used approach to Boolean optimization in practice is using implicit don't cares, which are introduced due to the network itself. And we've seen how to derive the don't care set of nodes inputs here by looking at its fan-in nodes, the nodes that feed it, and simplifying the nodes using the implicit don't care. So this is what we've looked at today. We'll continue the discussion on implicit don't cares and simplification of the circuit using implicit don't cares in the next lecture. Thank you.